Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Later in this hour, the President of the United States, President Obama's end-of-the-year news press conference, will have special NPR coverage.
But first, major developments today in the fight against ISIS in Iraq. Kurdish fighters say they have broken the ISIS militant siege of Mount Sinjar, where thousands of minority Yazidis have been trapped for months. The Kurds have been able to deliver food and water to the Yazidis in the last 24 hours, but sporadic fighting is still being reported around the mountain. I spoke earlier with the BBC's G.R. Goal in Erbil in northern Iraq.
The operation has started a couple of days ago with the help of coalition air force, and they have managed to open a corridor and they have reached the mountain. I have heard from one of the Kurdish commander, he said, Kurdish Peshmerga forces from the ground, they have managed to reach the Kurdish fighters in the mountain who were on the top of the mountain, in fact, protecting Yazidis who escaped IS militants in August.
And that is when the world started to see what was going on Mount Sinjar. We know the U.S. dropped food and water to the Yazidis back in August. How have the Yazidis been able to survive there since then?
Well, the situation is very dire because the mountain is cold, is winter here, and it's not a very good situation. And they have been able to just to send them aid, food, and basic needs just via a few old rundown Soviet helicopter in the past few months. And I was there. I was one of those journalists who managed at the beginning with this helicopter. I went there. We went again from Syrian site of Kurdistan, which the Kurdish fighters there, they open a corridor, bring down many of those refugees. The situation is not good. It's cold. They are living in tents. But I think this corridor has been opened by the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. It will be hope. First of all, they can send aids via roads much easier in much bigger containers. At the same time, bring down those people who wants to leave the mountain. But what I'm hearing, some of the families in the mountain, they prefer to stay in the mountain rather than going down living in the refugee camps. Some of them are hoping soon the Sinjar city and the villages around Sinjar region be recaptured so they could go home.
So they would prefer to stay on this mountain in the elements than come down and go to a refugee camp?
Some of them, not all of them, some of them have expressed that they want to leave immediately. But on the other hand, the Kurdish Peshmerga forces say that bringing them down is not that safe. But they are starting bring them down today because of the booby traps, mine and explosive has been planted in the villages and the roads leading to the mountain by IS militants when they were running away. But again, I mean, some of them, they prefer to stay in the mountain because there's a many villages in that area too, in the top of the mountain. Some people have relatives. Some people, they prefer to stay there, and they say they want to go home. They don't want to go to refugee camps.
We recently spoke on the program with Vianda Keel, a Yazidi member of the Iraqi parliament, who told us she thought ISIS was winning the war in Iraq. What do you think?
Well, I think obviously many people are frustrated with the situation, particularly Yazidi community. Don't forget, we are hearing the brutal stories of those people who have been abducted, particularly the Yazidi woman. They've been sold as a slave in the market of Tikrit and Mosul, or being used as a sex slave. This is really difficult for the community to bear. That's why they are impatient. They want their city, their villages to be freed soon so they can go home. They want the international community, entire Iraqi government, help the community and also help those people who are kidnapped to be brought back home. That's why she's very angry. But obviously, I don't think IS militants are winning. But the reality is many people here, they expect the Iraqi government and the Kurdish forces be able to recapture the city, liberate their cities and houses and villages so they can go home. That's why many of them, they believe IS militants are on the march. But what we have seen in the past few weeks, there is a sign, actually, the IS are retreating, they are losing grounds. And obviously, by losing ground, definitely discourage many young people in the Sunni area to join IS militant groups.
That's the BBC's Ghiar Gol in Erbil in northern Iraq. Ghiar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, another topic the president will surely be asked about later this hour during his end-of-the-year press conference is immigration. Remember the summer's crisis, the thousands of unaccompanied minors from Central America? One in three of these so-called border kids is still in the U.S., released to sponsors, usually a relative, while they wait their fate in immigration court. Many are seeking asylum, claiming that gang-related violence and extreme poverty threaten their lives. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's David Boeri traveled to El Salvador to learn more. And this warning, David's report contains graphic descriptions of violence.
Through crowded streets in the capital city of San Salvador, new white vans and pickups have been conveying a steady supply of corpses to the office of the medical examiner. 52 murders in 72 hours, say the newspaper headlines. In the receiving room, the victims have kept the metal autopsy tables and attending doctors at full capacity. On display are the youth of El Salvador.
70% of the people who are killed are between 15 and 30 years old,
says Dr. Miguel Enrique Velasquez. According to a recent report from UNICEF, El Salvador has the world's highest rate of homicide for children and adolescents, and it's rising.
We are taught by nature that children bury their parents, but here in El Salvador, it's the opposite. Parents bury their children.
Many of those murders stem from the brutal violence of criminal gangs at war with each other and with El Salvador itself. I asked the chief medical examiner, Jose Miguel Fortin, if he can tell when the murders are committed by gangs. When a head is found, but no body, he replies, that's a gang murder. When there is a body, but it's been dismembered, that's a narco-trafficking murder. And when the body was dismembered while the person was alive, that's a Mexican narco-trafficking murder. In the densely packed barrios of the municipality of Mexicanos, National Police Inspector Jorge Alberto Vasquez leads a force of 70 officers. With automatic handguns strapped to their thighs and rifles in their hands, they patrol neighborhoods in the foothills of the volcano San Salvador. We're having problems with gangs fighting for territory, the inspector says. It's in the slums and marginalized communities like this one, where half of El Salvador lives in poverty, that gangs have taken hold like tropical vines. The two biggest gangs are the notorious Made in America Mara Salvatrucha, a.k.a. MS-13, and its rival, known as MS-18 or 18th Street. They come with assault weapons, many with tattoos etched on their faces. The cops call this neighborhood a Zona Roja, or Red Zone, because the gangs are fighting for control. MS-13 is trying to take over.
Last weekend, in this house, killed a woman.
Woman was murdered, one?
Yes, the last weekend.
Then the inspector starts pointing.
So people have been murdered in this house?
Yes.
They've been murdered here, they've been murdered in that house, which is about 50 feet away?
Yes.
They've been murdered over here, which is another 50 feet away?
Over there, yes.
When you count gang members, the inspector says, you should add mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, and cousins. Rival gangs think the same way. When one joins, the whole family joins. That woman who died here a week ago Sunday, the inspector tells me that first, she lost a son, shot to death by MS-13. Next, gang members came for her son-in-law. They killed him too. Then they came back for the woman's daughter, shot her three times in the stomach.
I pleaded with the mother, they're going to kill you. They're going to kill you. We told her several times, you have to get away. And now she's dead. She ignored our advice. It seems like people are resigned to their deaths. They know it's coming for them.
In the civil war that raged into the 1990s, this municipality of Mexicanos suffered some of the worst fighting. Across the country, right-wing death squads and army soldiers tortured and murdered with impunity. 75,000 Salvadorans died. Since the war ended,
73,000 have been murdered. And sons and grandsons of that war's soldiers are at the center of this one. Sandra Serrano is now a student at college.
First there were the death squads and now the gangs, which I think are much worse. Gangs are the 21st century death squads.
The country is no bigger than Massachusetts, and with the same population, yet 12 murders a day. As murders rise by 50%, the number of unaccompanied children coming to the U.S. border with Mexico has jumped almost 300%.
58% of children are fleeing for violent gangs.
It's the prime reason they're leaving, says researcher Carla Castillo. She helped interview 600 Salvadoran children who were caught in Mexico this summer and sent back home. Some were as young as 7, most between 12 and 17. And traveling without their parents, they risked murder, kidnapping, rape, beatings, and even the danger of falling from atop the Mexican freight train known as La Bestia, the Beast. Their choice, they told Castillo, was to leave El Salvador or to die.
The gangs are trying to recruit the children to join to the gangs. And if the children don't accept to join the gang, the gang members are going to kill the children.
Kill them?
Kill them.
Atop a hill facing the volcano San Salvador, police inspector Jorge Alberto Vasquez points to a huge water tank on the summit of another hill. Towering letters and numbers read MS-13. It's like a pyramid with the gangs on top. But the pyramid must have new soldiers. And so the gangs recruit boys and girls alike at adolescence, even younger. In schools and neighborhoods, they recruit by force. Initiation rites include beatdowns and gang rape and missions to kill rivals. A glimmer of hope is the fact that so many adolescents have rejected the gangs. The bad news is that they've had to flee their own homes for places like L.A. and Boston. The worst news is that if they're sent back home, they'll have to face an even bigger danger, the gangs whose threats made them run away in the first place. For Here and Now, I'm David Boeri.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and we're just a few minutes away from the president's year-end news conference, and we're joined by three NPR correspondents who've been closely following the issues that are expected to come up. Joining us from Washington, Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Michelle Kellerman is also with us, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Welcome, Michelle.
Nice to be here.
And on the line from Sao Paulo, Brazil, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR's Latin American correspondent. Welcome, Lulu, to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And let's start with you. You've covered Cuba. Let's start right there. Care to guess what the president might say? Might there be any more surprises?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's hard to top what happened this week. Historic agreement saying that basically ties were going to be renewed between Cuba and the United States. So certainly he will be questioned on that. As we know, there's been a lot of opposition among certain members of Congress about his plans. And so I think there will be a few questions as to how this will be implemented, what we can expect in the days and months and years ahead.
Mm-hmm. Scott Horsley, if you had asked me yesterday what would be the number one issue that would be asked at the news conference, I would have said Cuba. But then today we get this news that the FBI has concluded that the North Korean government is responsible for the Sony hacks that has really been a huge firestorm. Now, what about that? Do you think that's going to – how is he going to have to respond to that?
Well, I'm sure the president will be asked about that, and you're right. The administration had been saying sort of quietly on background before this that they believe North Korea played a role in the Sony hacks, but now the FBI is saying on the record we've got enough information to draw that conclusion and to put that conclusion out there publicly. The challenge for the president is, now that you've said that, what are you going to do about it? And there are not a lot of great options for this White House as they think about how to retaliate for that attack.
Yeah, Michelle Kellerman, weigh in on that. You are the diplomatic correspondent. Of course, we don't have diplomatic relations with North Korea. But as we are in what CNN is calling the pregame of the president's press conference, which should be any minute now, your thoughts on what's going on behind the scenes? What's happening?
Well, I mean, this administration has certainly tried to keep North Korea in a box and not
react too strongly every time it does something provocative, but they really are going to have to respond here, given that they're calling this a major cyber attack and treating it as a national security issue. Robert Menendez, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has already written to John Kerry, the Secretary of State, saying it's time maybe to put North Korea back on the state sponsors of terrorism list.
Well, and NBC is reporting that the White House says it's planning a proportional response to the hack of Sony Pictures Entertainment. But what would be proportional in North Korea? It's hard to think.
Well, in making that announcement, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said sometimes the correct response is not an obvious response. So it's possible it won't be something very overt and visible.
No. Scott, these are just a couple of issues, but there are a lot more things that are likely to come up at this news conference. And again, we're just waiting. President Obama expected to be out in the White House press room any minute now to talk about a whole range of issues. This has been a very different couple of months for the president, or I guess it's only been just a bit more than a month since the midterm elections, Scott Horsley.
Well, that's right. Of course, this has been an annual tradition for the president to take reporters' questions just before he leaves town for Hawaii. And oftentimes there's been sort of an up and down rhythm to the president's year. He often gets a little bit of a boost in December, sort of unexpectedly, and is able to kind of leave town on a high note. Earlier this week, Dan Pfeiffer, the White House advisor, wrote a piece that was supposed to be sort of a rebuttal to a Washington Post story saying that President Obama had the worst year in Washington for the second year in a row. Dan Pfeiffer says, not so. This was actually a pretty good year for the president, notwithstanding those terrible midterm election results. The economy is gaining strength and certainly outperforming most of the rest of the developed world. We had that historic breakthrough with China on climate just shortly after the midterm elections. And then, of course, this week's big news about Cuba.
Well, I wonder, Scott, just to stay with that for a second, do you anticipate that the president might be a little combative about that? There are many saying that he's not getting the credit that he should for the economy, for instance.
Yes, he was talking to a group of business leaders a couple of weeks ago and complained that, as he often does, about the sort of attention deficit disorder that the news media has in this town. For example, he said last summer there was all that focus on the tide of unaccompanied minors coming across from Central America. That problem has now pretty much been solved. Well, okay, so we stopped talking about it. For a while, we were obsessed with it. It was the administration's screw up. Then when they fixed the problem, nobody talks about it. Yeah. Likewise with Ebola. We had several weeks here where the threat of Ebola in this country, of course, the threat continues to be serious in West Africa, but the threat in this country was on everybody's mind. Then as soon as it turned out to sort of not be a big problem in this country, the news media stopped talking about it. Mm-hmm. The president, I think, will make a similar comment today that we focus on these sort of momentary crises, and then when they're tackled, we move on. And certainly the White House doesn't feel he gets the credit he deserves for that.
And Scott, Robin mentioned the economy there. Here we are, the Dow up about 10 points as we wait for the president right now, but it's jumped significantly in the last couple of days because
just catching a breath. Yeah.
Well, exactly, because of what the Fed did the other day. Is the president likely to comment on that? I know that he likes to stay away from getting too involved in what the Federal Reserve, which is an independent body, does.
Yeah, the White House is actually pretty religious about not commenting on what the Federal Reserve does. And they also certainly understand that a 700-point gain in the stock market doesn't mean much to average Americans who are really more concerned with what's in their paycheck than in what's in their pension plan or somebody's portfolio. But they had a great jobs report from the Labor Department earlier this month for the November job gains that for the first time in a long time showed wages growing significantly faster than inflation. Now, 1 month does not a trend make, but
it's been many months now.
Yeah.
As we see the job market continue to improve, we should start to see improvements in wage growth, and maybe that will then start to influence people's feelings about the president's handling of the economy, which have been pretty lousy for the last year. You know, people's shopping habits certainly seem to suggest that they're feeling better about the economy, and there are lots of positive indicators that hasn't really trickled into what they tell pollsters about the way they think the administration's handling the economy.
If you're just tuning in and saying, what? This is NPR special coverage of the president's press conference, his end-of-year press conference, which should be coming momentarily. Robin Young with Jeremy Hobson. Austin, speaking with Scott Horsley, Michelle Kellerman, and Lourdes Garcia Navarro, who's there in Brazil and has extensively covered Cuba. So we want Lulu to weigh in on what she hears when the president speaks there. But just give us your unique vantage point, from your unique vantage point, Lourdes. Tell us, what do you think Brazilians or, you know, people outside of the U.S. might be listening for, if they are listening at all? I'm thinking of immigration policy, maybe even the Senate torture report.
I think there's a lot that, of course, makes headlines whenever the president of the United States speaks. I mean, if you think about what we were just discussing, what the Fed's doing, that has enormous implications here in Brazil and other emerging economies, which are seeing their currencies tank. The price of oil is plunging. That is having a great deal of effect in a place like Brazil, in other economies of the region, Venezuela. So obviously, there's a great deal of interest, you know, when it comes to what the president of the United States says. Certainly, at the moment, there is a sort of a, I don't know how you would call it, a sort of spring happening. You know, you can't really underestimate the power of what happened this week with Cuba. Cuba has been a thorn in the side of U.S. policy in the region for a very long time. It is a subject that continually comes up when you talk to Latin Americans. They see Cuba very differently. They see it as an icon. They see it as a country that defied the imperial United States. And so the fact that he has taken this step is being very warmly welcomed at the moment. It doesn't erase the history, but certainly it is being very well received.
I was wondering, could you see a reaction as you could in Cuba with bells pealing? I mean, what did you see there?
No, you couldn't see a reaction. It doesn't have the same sort of immediate impact. But, you know, just within hours, you saw the presidents of pretty much every single country in the region celebrating this, saying that this was a historic moment and saying that they thought this day would never come and that they were ecstatic that it had. So, you know, diplomatically, politically, this is going to have, you know, ramifications for sure.
That was very much on the minds of the White House, too. They know how much of an albatross this has been when it comes to U.S. relations, not with Cuba, but with every other country in the hemisphere. And it's not just the leftist governments like Venezuela or Bolivia that are applauding this. It's even our more conservative friends in Colombia and Canada who for years have been urging the United States to reexamine and drop this, what they consider to be an outdated policy.
Absolutely. America's been alone on this for so long that it is really, across the board, right wing, left wing, everyone's seeing this as a positive thing.
Well, Michelle Kellerman, let me just bring you in here because as you look at this as NPR's diplomatic correspondent, tell us about some of the ways that we may not be thinking about this speech being viewed around the world through different prisms depending on which region we're talking about.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, we keep hearing about America is not leading enough and not taking initiative. I think the way this occurred really can change that image in the world. The falling oil prices is having an effect on a lot of different issues. It may have come into play on Cuba because Venezuela's economy is reeling from the low oil prices. Venezuela is a main benefactor. You're also seeing Russia now, which has been a very difficult relationship to manage for this administration. Its economy is tanking. The ruble is collapsing. The hope is, for the Obama administration at least, is that it can use some of this momentum to try to change its image in the world, but also to get some movement on some really key issues that it's facing.
Do you expect to hear from President Obama on Russia today? Do you think Russia will make the list of the topics that get brought up in this news
there
conference?
There are so many questions to be raised, but President Vladimir Putin had his 3-hour long end of the year news conference.
Let's hope
yesterday.
This one doesn't go for 3 hours.
So they tend to do the White House tends to be a bit shorter than that, at least. Yeah,
but what are, I mean, there's, as you said, there are so many, but we look at Ukraine, Russia's economy. What do you think we might hear?
And even on Iran, though, they've delayed work on that. They didn't meet the latest deadline, and now they have until June to try to come up with some sort of negotiated settlement to the nuclear issue with Iran. So there's a lot of different things in play. On Russia, President Obama just signed into law a bill that came out of Congress calling for more sanctions and authorizing him to give weapons to Ukraine. But these are things that the Obama administration really didn't want right now. He signed the bill, but does have some lingering concerns about where that's headed. And the Europeans don't seem to be really in the mood right now to ratchet up sanctions much more than where they are with Russia. Everyone's sort of in a wait and see to see if Putin sort of backs down in Ukraine, whether he changes his policy given all the financial woes that he has right now.
Didn't seem to sound like he might in the press conference. It's funny you mentioned Iran as well in brokering this nuclear agreement. We remember it not that long ago when it was thought that maybe Russia would help broker that agreement. That seems, though, now like ancient history with everything that's happened since.
Although Russia is a part of the, as they say, the P5 plus one that has been at the tables. And that's you know, sort of the way the Obama administration has always dealt with these complicated relationships and said, we are willing to have our disagreements with Russia where we have, and they're very serious disagreements, for example, on Ukraine, but also to work with Russia on issues like Iran, like Syria, where our interests may be aligned.
And North Korea, by
the
way. And we're hearing already that they're reaching out to the diplomatic grouping on North Korea to figure out a way to respond to these cyber attacks.
Obama has said in domestic politics, let's not let the fact that we disagree about one issue, let's say immigration, keep us from making progress on another area, maybe tax reform, where we might have interests that are aligned. He takes a similar approach to foreign policy and tries to compartmentalize these things and work with countries where we can and disagree where we must. In fact, even when it comes to Cuba, he says the fact that we're reopening diplomatic relations does not in any way mean that we're going to be any less vocal about criticizing the human rights record or the anti-democratic problems in Cuba. We'll just be doing it now in the context of normal diplomatic relations, the way we do with lots of other undemocratic countries.
Well, Scott, a lot of what we've been talking about here is foreign policy. Do you think that for the last couple of years of President Obama's presidency, now that he's got Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate, or will have as soon as we get to January, that he's really going to be a foreign policy president primarily, that those are the kinds of things that he can get done on his own?
Well, history shows that that's often what happens in the latter years of a presidency, especially if they're working with an opposition Congress. But I think the White House still has lots of things that it wants to accomplish domestically, too. Immigration, I suppose you could say, sort of spans those. Somewhat something where the president has power because of its partly foreign policy, but it has salience in every community domestically as well.
ISIS. Anyone who wants to weigh in on what the president might say, and someone said thorn inside.
And we should say, by the way, that just today we've gotten the news that Mount Sinjar, that they have created a pathway to get some more Yazidis who've been trapped in Iraq by ISIS on Mount Sinjar to get them off of that.
Yeah. So who wants to take that? ISIS.
I think the message on ISIS is that this is a long, drawn-out issue, that it's not just a military solution, that they're trying to take different approaches, but no one should expect any, you know, fast movement or an end to that conflict anytime soon.
Yeah, when talking about Iraq, you know, the military is talking about a years-long mission in terms of sort of reconstituting an Iraqi military that's capable of fighting, taking the fight to ISIS. And in Syria, the situation is even more dire. So we're not talking about something that's going to be solved probably even in the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
Well, it's interesting because after the Senate report on the techniques used by the CIA, torture techniques used by the CIA came out, there was a new conversation that suddenly exploded about, what about drones? Aren't drones equally bad? That seemed to, you know, kind of come quickly but then recede. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the president has certainly embraced the use of remotely piloted drones. It's from his point of view, it's a way to go after targets without putting U.S. pilots in danger. But I also think he is willing to have a larger conversation about rethinking what's been our sort of permanent war footing when it comes to all of these hostile areas. But I think the president has voted with his pen in a way in authorizing plenty of drone strikes.
If you're just joining us, this is special coverage from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young, and we're joined from Washington by NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, also in Washington, and on the line with us from Sao Paulo, Brazil, is NPR Latin America correspondent Lourdes Garcia-Navarro. And we're waiting for President Obama to come out and give what is expected to be his end-of-year news conference later today. He's going to take a flight with his family out to Hawaii, which he's done. Scott, is that every year since he's been president, he's gone out to Hawaii for the holidays?
Yeah, but he doesn't always get off on time. This is one of the few years when they've set a departure date and been able to stick to it. I can think of lots of years when departure's been delayed, or in one case he even had to return to Washington from Hawaii to take care of some
last-minute financial deadline or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. We were speculating this morning about how long this press conference would go, and someone said, well, he has to make his plane to Hawaii, and we reminded them the plane waits for the president.
Yes.
So we're waiting for him. But
I will say his flight is scheduled. His helicopter flight is scheduled to depart the South Lawn at 5:45 Eastern.
I think they push it back for him.
Yeah, right. And Lulu, I want to bring you in because we've been going through all the topics that might come up. There are just so many of them. We didn't even get to Afghanistan, race relations, Ferguson, Missouri. Want to pick up on what you think might be there. But Lulu, there in Brazil, but also having covered Cuba, there's been anticipation that Raul Castro, the current leader of Cuba, might come to the U.S. after this announcement of normalization of relations. Might we hear something about that?
I'm certain that, the question may be asked. I'm not so sure that the administration will make that public yet. I think certainly they have, when questioned on the matter, have not discarded the possibility. And that would be an extraordinary moment to have one of the Castro brothers actually come to the United States and be received at the White House, potentially. So it would be big news, certainly, if it happens. I think one of the things, though, looking at the whole Cuba situation, we tend to look at this so much about what the United States is doing, how this is perceived in the United States. And I think in Cuba, it's really interesting. People are welcoming this. They're very excited. You see all this news in the U.S. about all these companies that are anxious to go do business in Cuba. Carnival Cruise Lines wants to bring cruise ships to Cuba and bring American tourists to Cuba. And, when you talk to ordinary Cubans, there is a sense that, of course, they welcome change. They are looking forward to expanding their economy, to have new opportunities. But at the same time, many Cubans are very proud of their revolution. They do feel that it achieved a great deal. And they don't necessarily want a sort of tidal wave of American corporations coming in to Havana. They don't want to see McDonald's, as they say, on the Malecón. You are seeing sort of divided feelings on the island at the moment.
Oh, fascinating.
And it's not really going to happen all that quickly. I mean, some of the things are going to happen quickly, easing of some of the regulations, but it won't be open, season for tourists.
Exactly.
It's still specific categories of people that are able to travel, and the administration's going to make it easier for them. What could happen, relatively quickly is reestablishing an embassy, and these high-level talks. The Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere, Roberta Jacobson, is planning to go at the end of January to talk about that sort of the diplomatic normalization, the nuts and bolts of that.
Although what about an ambassador getting confirmed, Michelle, because Congress would have to do that?
That's right. I mean, already there's what's called an interest section. So there's an embassy staff there and a chief of mission who's there already. You could just change the sign on the door and make it an embassy. But when it comes, when the Senate comes in, is when they nominate an actual ambassador, and when they talk about the budget for the embassy. Those are things that the Senate, some of the senators that oppose this, say they're going to really look into when the time comes.
Yeah. I will say that the White House spokesman Josh Earnest left the door open this week to either a Castro visiting the United States or President Obama visiting Cuba. But before either of those things is likely to happen, the two leaders will be together. Panama is hosting the OAS meeting this spring. And that would have been a very awkward meeting for President Obama because Panama had already extended an invitation to Raul Castro. So Castro was going to be there. Cuba has been excluded from those meetings in the past. And the United States always gets an earful about that exclusion and complaints about that exclusion. But now that earful will be very different. They'll be congratulating the U.S. on the reopening, and we will have another handshake moment. Of course, there was a handshake already at the funeral of Nelson Mandela, but this will be a sort of more formal diplomatic handshake.
Well, guys, we've just been told we're about a minute and a half away now from President Obama having his year-end press conference at the White House. We mentioned race relations stories this year that were spasms: Ferguson, Missouri; Staten Island, New York. Scott, just briefly,
put that in the same category the sense that Obama's not dismissing those as flash-in-the-pan cases. Obviously, that's something that's going to be with us for a long time. He's even talked about that as something that he'll be working on long after he leaves the White House. But it certainly could be the source of a question at this briefing,
sure,
at this news conference.
So we've got Cuba, we've got immigration, we've got North Korea and hacking, we've got race relations, a lot of topics expected from President Obama as he is about to begin his end-of-year news conference before he heads off to Hawaii for the holidays. He's going to be answering questions from the press corps. We'll be carrying it live right here. We want to ask our guests, Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent, NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, and NPR's Latin America correspondent Lourdes Garcia Navarro, to stand by as we wait for President Obama, who should be coming up just any minute now. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR. Here he is.
Hello, everybody. They really got a full house today, huh? Well, all I want for Christmas is to take your questions. But first, let me say a little bit about this year. In last year's final press conference, I said that 2014 would be a year of action and would be a breakthrough year for America. And it has been. Yes, there were crises that we had to tackle around the world, many that were unanticipated. We have more work to do to make sure our economy, our justice system, and our government work not just for the few, but for the many. But there is no doubt that we can enter into the new year with renewed confidence that America is making significant strides where it counts. The steps that we took early on to rescue our economy and rebuild it on a new foundation helped make 2014 the strongest year for job growth since the 1990s. All told, over a 57-month streak, our businesses have created nearly 11 million new jobs. Almost all of the job growth that we've seen have been in full-time positions. Much of the recent pickup in job growth has been in higher-paying industries. And in a hopeful sign for middle-class families, wages are on the rise again. Our investments in American manufacturing have helped fuel its best stretch of job growth also since the 1990s. America is now the number one producer of oil, the number one producer of natural gas. We're saving drivers about 70 cents a gallon at the pump over last Christmas. And effectively, today, our rescue of the auto industry is officially over. We've now repaid taxpayers every dime and more of what my administration committed, and the American auto industry is on track for its strongest year since 2005. And we've created about 500,000 new jobs in the auto industry alone. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, about 10 million Americans have gained health insurance just this past year. Enrollment is beginning to pick up again during the open enrollment period. The uninsured rate is at a near record low. Since the law passed, the price of health care has risen at its slowest rate in about 50 years. And we've cut our deficits by about two-thirds since I took office, bringing them to below their 40-year average. Meanwhile, around the world, America's leading. We're leading the coalition to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL, a coalition that includes Arab partners. We're leading the international community to check Russian aggression in Ukraine. We are leading the global fight to combat Ebola in West Africa. And we are preventing an outbreak from taking place here at home. We're leading efforts to address climate change, including last month's joint announcement with China that's already jump-starting new progress in other countries. We're writing a new chapter in our leadership here in the Americas by turning a new page on our relationship with the Cuban people. And in less than 2 weeks, after more than 13 years, our combat mission in Afghanistan will be over. Today, more of our troops are home for the holidays than any time in over a decade. Still, many of our men and women in uniform will spend Christmas in harm's way, and they should know that the country is united in support of you and grateful not only to you but also to your families. The 6 years since the crisis have demanded hard work and sacrifice on everybody's part. But as a country, we have every right to be proud of what we've accomplished. More jobs, more people insured, a growing economy, shrinking deficits, bustling industry, booming energy. Pick any metric that you want, America's resurgence is real. We are better off. I've always said that recovering from the crisis of 2008 was our first order of business. And on that business, America's outperformed all of our other competitors. Over the past 4 years, we've put more people back to work than all other advanced economies combined. We've now come to a point where we have the chance to reverse an even deeper problem, the decades-long erosion of middle-class jobs and incomes, and to make sure that the middle class is the engine that powers our prosperity for decades to come. But to do that, we're going to have to make some smart choices. We've got to make the right choices. We're going to have to invest in the things that secure even faster growth in higher-paying jobs for more Americans. And I'm being absolutely sincere when I say I want to work with this new Congress to get things done, to make those investments, to make sure the government's working better and smarter. We're going to disagree on some things, but there are going to be areas of agreement, and we've got to be able to make that happen. And that's going to involve compromise every once in a while. And we saw during this lame duck period that perhaps that spirit of compromise may be coming to the fore. In terms of my own job, I'm energized. I'm excited about the prospects for the next couple of years. And I'm certainly not going to be stopping for a minute in the effort to make life better for ordinary Americans. Because thanks to their efforts, we really do have a new foundation that's been laid. We are better positioned than we have been in a very long time. A new future is ready to be written. We've set the stage for this American moment. And I'm going to spend every minute of my last 2 years making sure that we seize it. My presidency is entering the fourth quarter. Interesting stuff happens in the fourth quarter. And I'm looking forward to it. But, you know, going into the fourth quarter, you usually get a timeout. I'm now looking forward to a quiet timeout, Christmas with my family. So I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, a Happy New Year. I hope that all of you get us some time to spend with your families as well, because one thing that we share is that we're away too much from them. And now, Josh has given me the who's been naughty and who's been nice list, and I'm going to use it to take some questions. And we're going to start with Carrie Budoff, Brown, Politico. There you go, Carrie.
Thank you, Mr. President. Start in North Korea, because that seems to be the biggest topic today. What does a proportional response look like to the Sony hack? And did Sony make the right decision in pulling the movie, or does that set a dangerous precedent when faced with this kind of situation?
Well, let me address the second question first. Sony's a corporation. It suffered significant damage. There were threats against its employees. I am sympathetic to the concerns that they faced. Having said all that, yes, I think they made a mistake. In this interconnected digital world, there are going to be opportunities for hackers to engage in cyber assaults, both in the private sector and the public sector. Now, our first order of business is making sure that we do everything to harden sites and prevent those kinds of attacks from taking place. When I came into office, I stood up a cybersecurity interagency team to look at everything that we could do at the government level to prevent these kinds of attacks. We've been coordinating with the private sector, but a lot more needs to be done. We're not even close to where we need to be. And one of the things in the new year that I hope Congress is prepared to work with us on is strong cybersecurity laws that allow for information sharing across private sector platforms as well as the public sector so that we are incorporating best practices and preventing these attacks from happening in the first place. But even as we get better, you know, the hackers are going to get better too. Some of them are going to be state actors. Some of them are going to be non-state actors. All of them are going to be sophisticated, and many of them can do some damage. We cannot have a society in which some dictator someplace can start imposing censorship here in the United States. Because if somebody is able to intimidate folks out of releasing a satirical movie, imagine what they start doing when they see a documentary that they don't like or news reports that they don't like. Or even worse, imagine if producers and distributors and others start engaging in self-censorship because they don't want to offend the sensibilities of somebody whose sensibilities probably need to be offended. That's not who we are. That's not what America's about. I'm sympathetic that Sony, as a private company, was worried about liabilities and this and that and the other. I wish they had spoken to me first. I would have told them, do not get into a pattern in which you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks. Imagine if, instead of it being a cyber threat, somebody had broken into their offices and destroyed a bunch of computers and stolen disks. And is that what it takes for suddenly you to pull the plug on something? We'll engage with not just the film industry, but the news industry and the private sector around these issues. We already have. We will continue to do so. But I think all of us have to anticipate occasionally there are going to be breaches like this. They're going to be costly. They're going to be serious. We take them with the utmost seriousness. But we can't start changing our patterns of behavior any more than we stop going to a football game because there might be the possibility of a terrorist attack. Any more than Boston didn't run its marathon this year because of the possibility that somebody might try to cause harm. Let's not get into that way of doing business.
Can you just say what the response would be for this attack? And then also, would you consider taking some sort of symbolic step like watching the movie yourself or doing some sort of screening here?
I've got a long list of movies I'm going to be watching. I never released my full movie list. Let's talk of the specifics of what we now know. The FBI announced today that, and we can confirm that North Korea engaged in this attack. I think it says something interesting about North Korea that they decided to have the state mount an all-out assault on a movie studio because of a satirical movie starring Seth Rogen and James Flacco. I love Seth, and I love James, but the notion that that was a threat to them, I think gives you some sense of the kind of regime we're talking about here. They caused a lot of damage, and we will respond. We will respond proportionally, and we'll respond in a place and time and manner that we choose. It's not something that I will announce here today at a press conference. More broadly, though, this points to the need for us to work with the international community to start setting up some very clear rules of the road in terms of how the internet and cyber operates. Right now, it's sort of the Wild West. And part of the problem is you've got weak states that can engage in these kinds of attacks. You've got non-state actors that can do enormous damage. That's part of what makes this issue of cybersecurity so urgent. Again, this is part of the reason why it's going to be so important for Congress to work with us and get a actual bill passed that allows for the kind of information sharing we need. Because, you know, if we don't put in place the kind of architecture that can prevent these attacks from taking place, this is not just going to be affecting movies. This is going to be affecting our entire economy in ways that are extraordinarily significant. And by the way, I hear you're moving to Europe. Where are you going to be?
Brussels.
Brussels.
Yes, helping Politico start a new publication.
Well, congratulations.
I've been covering you since the beginning, so.
Well, I think.
It's been a long road.
I think there's no doubt that what Belgium needs is a version of Politico. Yeah, the waffles are delicious there, by the way. The Cheryl Bowen, you've been naughty. Cheryl, go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. Looking ahead to your work with Congress next year, you've mentioned as an area of possible compromise tax reform. And so I am wondering, do you see a Republican Congress as presenting a better opportunity for actually getting tax reform next year? Will you be putting out a new proposal? Are you willing to consider both individual and corporate side of the tax ledger there? And also, are you still concerned about corporate inversions?
I think an all-Democratic Congress would have provided an even better opportunity for tax reform. But I think talking to Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell, that they are serious about wanting to get some things done. The tax area is one area where we can get things done. And I think in the coming weeks leading up to the State of the Union, there will be some conversations at the staff levels about what principles each side are looking at. I can tell you broadly what I'd like to see. I'd like to see more simplicity in the system. I'd like to see more fairness in the system. With respect to the corporate tax reform issue, we know that there are companies that are paying the full freight, 35% higher than just about any other company on earth if you're paying 35%. And then there are other companies that are paying zero because they've got better accountants or lawyers. That's not fair. There are companies that are parking money outside the country because of tax avoidance. We think that it's important that everybody pays something if, in fact, they are effectively headquartered in the United States. In terms of corporate inversion, those are situations where companies really are headquartered here, but on paper switch their headquarters to see if they can avoid their paying their fair share of taxes. I think that needs to be fixed. So fairness, everybody paying their fair share, everybody taking responsibility, I think is going to be very important. Some of those principles I've heard Republicans say they share. How we do that, you know, the devil's in the details. And I'll be interested in seeing what they want to move forward. I'm going to make sure that we put forward some pretty specific proposals, building on what we've already put forward. One other element of this that I think is important is, and I've been on this hobby horse now for 6 years, bless you, we've got a lot of infrastructure we got to rebuild in this country if we're going to be competitive. Roads, bridges, ports, airports, electrical grids, water systems, sewage systems. We are way behind. And early on, we indicated that there is a way of us potentially doing corporate tax reform, lowering rates, eliminating loopholes so everybody's paying their fair share, and during that transition also providing a mechanism where we can get some infrastructure built. I'd like to see us work on that issue as well. Historically, obviously, infrastructure has not been a Democratic or a Republican issue, and I'd like to see if we can return to that tradition. Julie Pace.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to ask about Cuba. What would you say to dissidents or democracy advocates inside Cuba who fear that the policy changes you announced this week could give the Castro regime economic benefits without having to address human rights or their political system? When your administration was lifting sanctions on Myanmar, you sought commitments of reform. Why not do the same with Cuba? And if I could just follow up on North Korea, do you have any indication that North Korea was acting in conjunction with another country, perhaps China?
We've got no indication that North Korea was acting in conjunction with another country. With respect to Cuba, we are glad that the Cuban government has released slightly over 50 dissidents, that they are going to be allowing the International Committee of the Red Cross and the United Nations human rights agencies to operate more freely inside of Cuba and monitor what is taking place. I share the concerns of dissidents there and human rights activists that this is still a regime that represses its people. And as I said when I made the announcement, I don't anticipate overnight changes. But what I know deep in my bones is that if you've done the same thing for 50 years and nothing's changed, you should try something different if you want a different outcome. And this gives us an opportunity for a different outcome, because suddenly Cuba is open to the world in ways that it has not been before. It's open to Americans traveling there in ways that it hasn't been before. It's open to church groups visiting their fellow believers inside of Cuba in ways they haven't been before. It offers the prospect of telecommunications and the Internet being more widely available in Cuba in ways that it hasn't been before. And over time, that chips away at this hermetically sealed society, and I believe offers the best prospect then of leading to greater freedom, greater self-determination on the part of the Cuban people. I think it'll happen in fits and starts, but through engagement, we have a better chance of bringing about change than we would have otherwise.
Okay. Do you have a goal for where you see Cuba being at the end of your presidency?
I think it'd be unrealistic for me to map out exactly where Cuba will be. But change is going to come to Cuba. It has to. They've got an economy that doesn't work. They've been reliant for years, first on subsidies from the Soviet Union, then on subsidies from Venezuela. Those can't be sustained. And the more the Cuban people see what's possible, the more interested they are going to be in change. But how societies change is country-specific, it's culturally specific. It could happen fast, it could happen slower than I'd like, but it's going to happen, and I think this change of policy is going to advance that. Leslie Clark.
Thank you, Mr. President. I had a number of questions on Cuba as well. Okay. Appreciate that. I wanted to
I have to write all these down? How many? A number sounded intimidating.
As quick as I can. quick as I can.
Okay.
I wanted to see if you got any assurances from the Cuban government that it would not revert to the same sort of sabotage the deal as it has in the past when presidents have made similar overtures to the government.
Be specific. What do you mean?
When the Clinton administration made some overtures, they shot down planes. They sort of had this pattern of doing provocative.
So just general
provocative activities. Anytime the U.S. has sort of reached out a hand to them.
Okay.
I wanted to see what is your knowledge of whether Fidel Castro, did he have any role in the talks? Did you talk, when you talked to President Castro, Raul Castro, did Fidel Castro's name come up? Or did you ask about him? How's he doing? People haven't seen him in a while. Given the deep opposition from some Republicans in Congress to lifting the embargo, to an embassy, to any of the changes that you're doing, are you going to personally get involved in terms of talking to them about efforts that they want to do to block money on a new embassy?
All right, Leslie, I think I'm going to cut you off here. Now, this is taking up a lot of time.
Okay, all right.
All right. So with respect to sabotage, I mean, my understanding of the history, for example, the plane being shot down, it's not clear that was the Cuban government purposely trying to undermine overtures by the Clinton administration. It was a tragic circumstance that ended up collapsing talks that had begun to take place. I haven't seen a historical record that suggests that they shot the plane down specifically in order to undermine overtures by the Clinton government. I think it is not precedented for the President of the United States and the President of Cuba to make an announcement at the same time that they are moving towards normalizing relations. So there hasn't been anything like this in the past. That doesn't mean that over the next 2 years we can't anticipate them taking certain actions that we may end up finding deeply troubling, either inside of Cuba or with respect to their foreign policy. And that could put significant strains on the relationship. But that's true of a lot of countries out there where we have an embassy. And the whole point of normalizing relations is that it gives us a greater opportunity to have influence with that government than not. So I would be surprised if the Cuban government purposely tries to undermine what is now effectively its own policy. I wouldn't be surprised if they take at any given time actions that we think are a problem. And we will be in a position to respond to whatever actions they take the same way we do with a whole range of countries around the world when they do things we think are wrong. The point is that we will be in a better position, I think, to actually have some influence. And there may be carrots as well as sticks that we can then apply. The only way that Fidel's name came up, I think I may have mentioned this in the David Muir article interview that I did, was I delivered a fairly lengthy statement at the front end about how we're looking forward to a new future in the relationship between our two countries, but that we are going to continue to press on issues of democracy and human rights, which we think are important. My opening remarks probably took about 15 minutes, which on the phone is a pretty long time. And at the end of that, he said, Mr. President, you're still a young man. Perhaps you have the opportunity. At the end of my remarks, I apologized for taking, such a long time, but I wanted to make sure that before we engage in the conversation, that he was very clear about where I stood. He said, "Oh, don't worry about it, Mr. President. You're still a young man, and you have still the chance to break Fidel's record. He once spoke 7 hours straight. And then President Castro proceeded to deliver his own preliminary remarks that lasted at least twice as long as mine. And then I was able to say, obviously, it runs in the family. But that was the only discussion of Fidel Castro that we had. I sort of forgot all the other questions.
I have a few more. How personally involved are you going to get in?
Well, with respect to Congress, we cannot unilaterally bring down the embargo. That's codified in the Libertad Act. And what I do think is going to happen, though, is there's going to be a process where Congress digests it. There are bipartisan supporters of our new approach. There are bipartisan detractors of this new approach. People will see how the actions we take unfold. And I think there's going to be a healthy debate inside of Congress. And I will certainly weigh in. I think that ultimately we need to go ahead and pull down the embargo, which I think has been self-defeating in advancing the aims that we're interested in. But I don't anticipate that happens right away. I think people are going to want to see how does this move forward before there's any serious debate about whether or not we would make major shifts in the embargo. All right. Roberta Rampton. There you go.
I wanted to follow on that by asking, under what conditions would you meet with President Castro in Havana? Would you have certain preconditions that you would want to see met before doing that? And on the hack, I know that you said that you're not going to announce your response, but can you say whether you're considering additional economic or financial sanctions on North Korea? Can you rule out the use of military force or some kind of cyber hit of your own?
I think I'm going to leave it where I left it, which is we just confirmed that it was North Korea. We have been working up a range of options. They will be presented to me. I will make a decision on those based on what I believe is proportional and appropriate to the nature of this crime. With respect to Cuba, we're not at a stage here where me visiting Cuba or President Castro coming to the United States is in the cards. I don't know how this relationship will develop over the next several years. I'm a fairly young man, so I imagine that at some point in my life I will have the opportunity to visit Cuba and enjoy interacting with the Cuban people. But there's nothing specific where we're trying to target some sort of visit on my part. Colleen McCain-Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. President.
There you are.
You spoke earlier about 2014 being a breakthrough year, and you ended the year with executive actions on Cuba and immigration and climate change. But you didn't make much progress this year on your legislative agenda, and some Republican lawmakers have said they're less inclined to work with you if you pursue executive actions so aggressively. Are you going to continue to pursue executive actions if that creates more roadblocks for your legislative agenda? Or have you concluded that it's not possible to break the fever in Washington and the partisan gridlock here?
I think there are real opportunities to get things done in Congress. As I said before, I take Speaker Boehner and Mitch McConnell at their words that they want to get things done. I think the American people would like to see us get some things done. The question is going to be, are we able to separate out those areas where we disagree and those areas where we agree? I think there are going to be some tough fights on areas where we disagree. If Republicans seek to take health care away from people who just got it, they will meet stiff resistance from me. If they try to water down consumer protections that we put in place in the aftermath of the financial crisis, I will say no. And I'm confident that I'll be able to uphold vetoes of those types of provisions. but on increasing American exports, on simplifying our tax system, on rebuilding our infrastructure. My hope is that we can get some things done. I've never been persuaded by this argument that if it weren't for the executive actions, they would have been more productive. There's no evidence of that. So I intend to continue to do what I've been doing, which is where I see a big problem and the opportunity to help the American people, and it is within my lawful authority to provide that help, I'm going to do it. And I will then, side by side, reach out to members of Congress, reach out to Republicans and say, let's work together. I'd rather do it with you. Immigration's the classic example. I was really happy when the Senate passed a bipartisan comprehensive immigration bill. And I did everything I could for a year and a half to provide Republicans the space to act and showed not only great patience but flexibility, saying to them, look, if there are specific changes you'd like to see, we're willing to compromise. We're willing to be patient. We're willing to work with you. Ultimately, it wasn't forthcoming. And so, you know, the question is going to be, I think, if executive actions on areas like minimum wage or equal pay or having a more sensible immigration system are important to Republicans, if they care about those issues and the executive actions are bothering them, there is a very simple solution, and that is pass bills and work with me to make sure I'm willing to sign those bills. Because both sides are going to have to compromise on most issues in order for their initiatives to become law. I'm going to have to sign off. And that means they have to take into account the issues that I care about, just as I'm going to have to take into account the issues that they care about. All right. I think this is going to be our last question. Juliet Alsprin. There you go.
Thanks so much. So one of the first bills that Mitch McConnell said he will send to you is one that would authorize the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Right.
When you've talked about this in the past, you've minimized the benefits and you've highlighted some of the risks associated with that project. I'm wondering if you could tell us both what you would do when faced with that bill, given the Republican majority that we'll have in both chambers, and also what you see as the benefits, and given the precipitous drop we've seen in oil prices recently, does that change the calculus in terms of how it would contribute to climate change and whether you think it makes sense to go ahead with that project?
Well, I don't think I've minimized the benefits. I think I've described the benefits. If at issue in Keystone is not American oil, it is Canadian oil that is drawn out of tar sands in Canada. That oil currently is being shipped out through rail or trucks, and it would save Canadian oil companies and the Canadian oil industry an enormous amount of money if they could simply pipe it all the way through the United States down to the Gulf. Once that oil gets to the Gulf, it is then entering into the world market, and it would be sold all around the world. So there's no, I won't say no. There is very little impact, nominal impact, on U.S. gas prices, what the average American consumer cares about, by having this pipeline come through. And sometimes the way this gets sold is, you know, let's get this oil and it's going to come here, and the implication is that that's going to lower gas prices here in the United States. It's not. There's a global oil market. It's very good for Canadian oil companies, and it's good for the Canadian oil industry, but it's not going to be a huge benefit to U.S. consumers. It's not even going to be a nominal benefit to U.S. consumers. Now, The construction of the pipeline itself will create probably a couple thousand jobs. Those are temporary jobs until the construction actually happens. There's probably some additional jobs that can be created in the refining process down in the Gulf. Those aren't, you know, completely insignificant. If, you know, it's just like any other project. But when you consider what we could be doing if we were rebuilding our roads and bridges around the country, something that Congress could authorize, we could probably create hundreds of thousands of jobs or a million jobs. So if that's the argument, there are a lot of more direct ways to create well-paying American construction jobs. And then with respect to the costs, all I've said is that I want to make sure that if, in fact, this project goes forward, that it's not adding to the problem of climate change, which I think is very serious and does impose serious costs on the American people. Some of them long-term, but significant costs nonetheless. If we've got more flooding, more wildfires, more drought, there are direct economic impacts on that. And as we're now rebuilding after Sandy, for example, we're having to consider how do we increase preparedness and how we structure infrastructure and housing and so forth along the Jersey Shore. That's an example of the kind of costs that are imposed, and you can put a dollar figure on it. So in terms of process, you've got a Nebraska judge that's still determining whether or not the new path for this pipeline is appropriate. Once that is resolved, then the State Department will have all the information it needs to make its decision. But I've just tried to give this perspective because I think that there's been this tendency to really hype this thing as some magic formula and to what ails the U.S. economy, and it's hard to see on paper where exactly they're getting that information from. In terms of oil prices and how it impacts the decision, I think that it won't have a significant impact, except perhaps in the minds of folks when gas prices are lower, maybe they're more less susceptible to the argument that this is the answer to lowering gas prices. But it was never going to be the answer to lowering gas prices because the oil that would be piped through the Keystone Pipeline would go into the world market, and that's what determines oil prices.
In terms of Congress forcing your hand on this, is this something where you clearly say you're not going to let Congress force your hand on whether to approve or disapprove this permit?
I'll see what they do. Yeah, we'll take that up in the new year. All right.
Any New Year's resolutions?
I'll ask. April, go ahead, April.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. President. Last question, I guess.
Mr. President,
6 years ago this month, I asked you what was the state of Black America in the Oval Office, and you said it was the best of times and the worst of times. You said it was the best in time of times in the sense that there has never been more opportunity for African Americans to have received a good education, and the worst of times for unemployment and the lack of opportunity. Well, ending 2014, what is the state of Black America as we talk about those issues, as well as race relations in this country?
Like the rest of America, Black America in the aggregate is better off now than it was when I came into office. The jobs that have been created, the people who've gotten health insurance, the housing equity that's been recovered, the 401 pensions that have been recovered, a lot of those folks are African American. They're better off than they were. The gap between income and wealth of white and Black America persists, and we've got more work to do on that front. I've been consistent in saying that this is a legacy of a troubled racial past, of Jim Crow and slavery. That's not an excuse for Black folks. And I think the overwhelming majority of black people understand it's not an excuse. They're working hard. They're out there hustling and trying to get an education, trying to send their kids to college. But, you know, they're starting behind oftentimes in the race. And what's true for all Americans is we should be willing to provide people a hand up, not a handout, but help folks get that good early childhood education, help them graduate from high school, help them afford college. If they do, they're going to be able to succeed, and that's going to be good for all of us. And we've seen some progress. The education reforms that we've initiated are showing measurable results. We have the highest high school graduation that we've seen in a very long time. We are seeing record numbers of young people attending college. You know, in many states that have initiated reforms, you're seeing progress in math scores and reading scores for African American and Latino students as well as the broader population. But we've still got more work to go. Now, obviously, how we're thinking about race relations right now has been colored by Ferguson, the Garner case in New York, a growing awareness in the broader population of what I think many communities of color have understood for some time, and that is that there are specific instances, at least, where law enforcement doesn't feel as if it's being applied in a colorblind fashion. The task force that I formed is supposed to report back to me in 90 days, not with a bunch of abstract musings about race relations, but some really concrete, practical things that police departments and law enforcement agencies can begin implementing right now to rebuild trust between communities of color and the police department. And my intention is to, as soon as I get those recommendations, to start implementing. Some of them we'll be able to do through executive action. Some of them will require congressional action. Some of them will require action on the part of states and local jurisdictions. But I actually think it's been a healthy conversation that we've had. These are not new phenomena. The fact that they're now surfacing, in part because people are able to film what have just been in the past stories passed on around a kitchen table, allows people to make their own assessments and evaluations. And you're not going to solve the problem if it's not being talked about. In the meantime, we've been moving forward on criminal justice reform issues more broadly. One of the things I didn't talk about in my opening statement is the fact that last year was the first time in 40 years where we had the federal prison population go down and the crime rate go down at the same time, which indicates the degree to which it's possible for us to think smarter about who we're incarcerating, how long we're incarcerating, how are we dealing with nonviolent offenders, how are we dealing with drug offenses, diversion programs, drug courts. We can do a better job of and save money in the process by initiating some of these reforms. And I've been really pleased to see that we've had Republicans and Democrats in Congress who are interested in these issues as well. The one thing I will say, and this is going to be the last thing I say, is that one of the great things about this job is you get to know the American people. I mean, you meet folks from every walk of life and every region of the country and every race and every faith. And what I don't think is always captured in our political debates is the vast majority of people are just trying to do the right thing. And people are basically good and have good intentions. Sometimes our institutions and our systems don't work as well as they should. Sometimes, you've got a police department that has gotten into bad habits over a period of time and hasn't maybe surfaced some hidden biases that we all carry around. But if you offer practical solutions, I think people want to fix these problems. This isn't a situation where people feel good seeing somebody choked and dying. I think that troubles everybody. So there's an opportunity of all of us to come together and, you know, to take a practical approach to these problems. And I guess that's my general theme for the end of the year, which is we've gone through difficult times. It is your job, press corps, to report on all the mistakes that are made and all the bad things that happen and the crises that look like they're popping, and I understand that. But through persistent effort and faith in the American people, things get better. The economy's gotten better. Our ability to generate clean energy has gotten better. We know more about how to educate our kids. We solve problems. Ebola is a real crisis. You get a mistake in the first case because it's not something that's been seen before. We fix it. You have some unaccompanied children who spike at a border, and it may not get fixed in the time frame of the news cycle, but it gets fixed. And you know, part of what I hope, as we reflect on the new year, this should generate us some confidence. America knows how to solve problems, and when we work together, we can't be stopped. And now I'm going to go on vacation. Mele Kalikimaka, everybody. Mahalo.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young, and you've just listened to President Obama's end-of-the-year press conference. He was about to leave the room when he took a last question from April Ryan from the American Urban Radio Network on the state of Black America, commenting there on recent issues in the news and concluding by saying, "It is a problem, but we're Americans, and America knows how to solve problems." He took questions also on North Korea's hacking of Sony, on Cuba, on corporate taxes, on working with the upcoming Republican Congress on the Keystone Pipeline. We have a few minutes to sort of round it up with some of our best NPR reporters who are with us standing by from Washington. We have Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you still.
And let's welcome back Michelle Kellerman, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Welcome to you as well, Michelle.
Thanks, Robin.
And Scott, I want to start with what jumped out of me right at the beginning of the question period. The president spoke for a few minutes, but then took questions for over half an hour. And he referred to the hacking, and he pretty much said that he thought Sony made a mistake. Tell us more about what he said.
That's right. Well, he said that the FBI has now concluded that North Korea is behind the hack attack on Sony Pictures over that film that offended North Korean sensibilities. And he said that the United States will take action to respond, proportional action to respond. But then when he was asked about the decision to not screen the movie, which was sort of first made by some of the major theater chains, and they said they wouldn't show the movie in response to threats of attacks at the screenings, and then finally Sony itself caved and said they're not going to distribute the film. He said, "I wish they'd asked me about that because I think it was a mistake." He referred to the Boston Marathon and you know, the sort of resilience there in the face of these kinds of threats, and said you can't knuckle under to these kinds of threats, or next time it won't just be a satirical movie they go after.
Yeah, and Michelle Kellerman, he went on to say, "I would have told Sony if they'd asked me not to get into a pattern where you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks." But when he was asked a little later, and there's a lot of time spent on the Sony hacking, when he was asked a little bit later if he could elaborate on what the response might be, could you rule out a military attack or your own cyber attack, he declined.
That's right. He didn't rule that out, but he also said that the response is going to be proportional and appropriate. He said he's working on a range of options. A cyber attack on North Korea, I'm not sure how many people that would affect, really. I guess the small group of hackers that they have. One of the other interesting things I thought he said, Robin, was that he said that North Korea was essentially acting alone, and that it's time really to work with other countries to have rules of the road for the internet. And I'd point out that the group of countries that the U.S. works together with on the North Korea nuclear issue include some countries that know a thing or two about hacking. They include China and Russia.
Yeah.
So, if they can coordinate some kind of response with them, then that could be quite an effective response.
You know, Robin, some of the cyber experts I've talked about say you really have to separate here. On the one hand, the hack, the stealing and exposing of all those embarrassing emails of Sony executives and so forth, from the cave, that is, the decision first by movie theaters and then by Sony not to screen the theaters. And if it hadn't been for the cave, if this had only been the exposure of all those embarrassing emails, the stakes would be so much lower. But now you have really gotten into First Amendment, free expression, and that's not necessarily the result of what the hackers did. That's a result of what Sony and the movie theaters did. By taking the action they did, which the president called a mistake, they really raised the stakes for everybody and put much more of an onus on the U.S. government to respond.
We have to jump. Go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, I was just going to say, and one of the things that President Obama pointed out was that he said you can't have a society in which some dictator can impose censorship here in the U.S. He was really pointing out that you don't want this country, having decisions here influenced by a guy like Kim Jong-un.
Right, right. But I'm sure we're going to hear from Hollywood because it wasn't just the theaters. It was other film companies, these huge, it's one of our biggest exports, popular culture, and these huge film studios were also telling Sony, we're afraid people won't come to see our movies. They won't go to the movie theater at all if you have your movie out there. And I'm sure...
Yeah, although the American people never really got a chance to make that decision.
Right,
did they?
Right.
We didn't get to show Boston Strong or Washington Strong.
Right.
We kind of had Hollywood Week.
Right. He was also asked, I thought it was interesting, are you going to watch the movie? He said he doesn't give away his movie list.
Well, but he's got a long list of movies to watch while he's in Hawaii.
Right. But Scott, start ticking off. What else jumped out at you? There's a lot of time spent on Sony and North Korea, but what else jumped out to you?
Well, the second to last question was interesting. We didn't get a lot in the answer from the president about the Keystone Pipeline, but the question itself was interesting. The Washington Post's White House correspondent, who's also a former environmental reporter and very knowledgeable about this subject, asked about whether the drop in oil prices will change the administration's calculus when it comes to the Keystone Pipeline. And it's interesting because at the beginning of 2014, when the State Department came out with their sort of preliminary finding on the pipeline proposal, they said Keystone, whether this pipeline gets built or not, won't make much difference to global warming, to climate change, because one way or another, the oil is going to get to market. If this pipeline isn't built, they'll simply put the oil on rail cars or they'll find other pipelines. The oil will still get to market. But that analysis was based on the assumption that oil prices stay high. At a price point of around $65 a barrel, the State Department said, that analysis might change. Well, now we're looking at oil that's well below $65 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And at that price point, the pipeline, the existence or non-existence of that pipeline has a more material impact on whether those tar sand oils are developed. The president didn't say that in his response, but the question is very interesting because it is possible that we will have a very different analysis of this pipeline's impact on climate change and the development of the tar sands than we would have $50 or $60 a barrel of oil ago.
Yeah. Michelle Kellerman, I want to ask you about his comments about Cuba. There were also many questions about Cuba, of course, but he was asked directly, under what conditions would you meet with Raul Castro, the leader? What about the embargo? Tell us a little bit more about what he said.
Well, the one big question is, will he go to Cuba or will Raul Castro come here? And he basically said that that's not in the cards yet, that there's no target date for that sort of thing. He said, I'm a young man, so he could see himself going to Cuba in the future. But he certainly didn't say that this was going to be, a sure thing during his presidency. The question really was about, how do you influence human rights issues if you're normalizing relations. And he said that, that Cuba, under this agreement, did agree to release more than 50 dissidents, allow the UN, the ICRC, and others to look into the situation a little bit more. He said, though, that this is still a regime that suppresses its people and that he thinks the reforms are going to be in fits and starts. But, you know, his approach is that more diplomatic ties, resuming this relationship, having an embassy there is a more effective way at promoting that kind of change rather than this, you know, more than 50 years of trying to isolate.
Yeah, in fact, we have – just 1 second, Scott, because we have a little bit of that comment, and then I want you to pick up on the other side. Scott, let's listen.
As I said when I made the announcement, I don't anticipate overnight changes. But what I know deep in my bones is that if you've done the same thing for 50 years and nothing's changed, you should try something different if you want a different outcome. And this gives us an opportunity for a different outcome.
Scott Horsley, pick it up there.
That's just the line I was I was going to point to. And I think that has really animated the White House thinking on this issue. It even animated the president back in his campaign days. If you go back to 2007, of course, he made headlines when he said provocatively at a Democratic debate that he would be willing to meet with the leaders of Cuba, leaders of Iran, leaders of North Korea, all the leaders that the U.S. had traditionally frozen out, because he says the notion that freezing out and isolating your enemies by itself is effective is not working. And nowhere is that more evident than in Cuba. I actually thought his comments on Cuba today had a little bit more spirit to them than his comments, his televised comments earlier this week, when he formally made the announcement of resuming diplomatic relations. Maybe he had one eye on Raul Castro in the split screen or something when he was delivering his remarks earlier this week. But you really hear it in what he said today. He knows in his bones if you're doing something for 50 years and the result you haven't gotten the results you want, maybe it's time to try something different.
Yeah. Scott, we also want to ask you about your thoughts on what he said in response to questions about whether or not he could work with a Republican Congress. He seemed to lay out pretty – there was sort of a paragraph in which he laid out the things that they could agree on and the things that they might not agree on. Your thoughts about that?
Well, he said he takes Mitch McConnell and John Boehner at their word that they want to work together. Of course, they said that right after the 2012 election as well, he'd won the election and that they were willing to find areas of common ground. We've seen very, very little of that in the last 2 years, and it doesn't seem we're going to see a whole lot more now that the Republicans triumphed in the midterm elections. But what struck me about what the president said there was, I don't buy this argument that it's my executive actions that are somehow holding them back. And he said there's very little evidence of that. And indeed, he did hold off on these kinds of executive actions all the way up until the midterm elections, all through the latter half of 2013 and the 2014, waiting for the Republican House to do something on immigration. Nothing happened. So he said, I'm not going to stop acting on my own where I can, because that's somehow going to poison the well, as the GOP has said. The well was poisoned before I did anything.
Yeah. Let's listen to the president in talking about congressional Republicans.
You know, the question is going to be, I think, if executive actions on areas like minimum wage or equal pay or having a more sensible immigration system are important to Republicans, if they care about those issues and the executive actions are bothering them, there is a very simple solution, and that is pass bills and work with me to make sure I'm willing to sign those bills.
And he also went on to say that sort of laundry list, it seemed to sort of put it in a nutshell, that if Republicans seek to take health care away from people who just got it or remove consumer protections, they will meet with stiff response from me. But on increasing American exports, simplifying the tax system, rebuilding the infrastructure, we can get things done, sort of laying out where he thought they could be working together.
And to be fair, the Republicans have cited those very same examples. Exports is certainly an area, and trade, where the Republicans have been more aligned with the president's agenda than some of his fellow Democrats have been. The Republican Party is pretty supportive of, for example, the big Pacific trade deal that the administration's been working on, where Democrats have been much more skeptical of that. And they certainly both sides talk about wanting tax reform, although the details is where the problems come in there. So the president says he's optimistic. We'll see.
Yeah. Michelle Cullimon, again from NPR, and Scott Horsley, NPR. As we have NPR's special coverage, this is sort of the post-game coverage of President Obama's press conference today. We've got a couple minutes left. I do want to ask about the last question he took about the state of Black America. He said basically people are trying to do the right thing. Sometimes there are police departments with biases. I'm sort of synopsizing what he said. But people don't feel good seeing someone choked and dying. That troubles everyone. This is an opportunity to come together and address this. Michelle, just your thoughts on his reflection on that question.
Well, it was interesting because he talked about these are issues that have been around for a long time. It's just now we're starting to see them on cell phones and having this debate in America. And he said it's a good thing to be having this debate. I mean, these are not issues that I cover in my beat, but it's interesting to see him reflect on that after this year of such high profile protests around the country.
Right. Well, and there is some sense, and people have in some ways tried to blame President Obama for this sometimes, the fact that there's been so much conversation about race relations as a sign that somehow race relations have turned worse. The president took issue with that and said, you're not going to solve a problem if it's not being talked about.
Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent, and Michelle Kellerman, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. We also earlier had Lourdes Garcia Navarro from Brazil, who's covered Cuba. As we listen to President Obama today speak for about 10 minutes and then take questions for, I think, about 40, 45 as he extended it towards the end there, before he boards a plane to go off to his holiday in Hawaii. This has been special coverage from NPR and WBUR. We're going to return you to your regularly scheduled programming. Thanks for listening. I'm Robin Young.